The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the Dorman Report for March 2017. Mike Consul here with Jeff Dorman. And if there's any place that Jeff Dorman spends way too much time, it's at airports. The reason I bring up airports is it's one of those places where we get very up close and personal with infrastructure. And Jeff, you not only travel around the United States, you travel around the world, Asia, Europe, South America, and so on. And one of the stark contrasts that business leaders and politicians draw between the United States and our infrastructure problems and the rest of the world is oftentimes airports. So as a jumping off point for a discussion on infrastructure, what have your observations been in the many, many airports around the world that you've been in, contrasting the United States with many other places in the world?
Well, you know, there are places in the world where the airports are worse than the United States. I mean, if you've ever, you know, chased the cockroaches in the Philippines, Manila Airport, or, you know, been to some of the South American airports, you'll know that, you know, the U.S.'s aren't the worst, but they certainly are far behind what you would consider to be, you know, modern airports. You know, places like Changi in Singapore, or, you know, the new airport, it's not so new anymore, in Hong Kong, the beautiful airport in Seoul, Korea, you know, the new airports outside of Japan. I mean, we're so far behind in terms of our airport development. I can't even think of a major city that's had a new airport developed in the past 20 years. Probably the last one was Denver. And so, you know, it's just... A lot of these airports were designed and developed before we even had the security protocols that we have in place right now. So they just don't flow traffic very well. And, you know, there's been efforts to fix things. I mean, it seems like almost every airport today is an ongoing work in progress. You know, San Francisco's constantly remaking itself. Chicago's been remaking itself and building new terminals. You know, JFK has been reconfiguring some of the terminals to go back to the 60s. So, you know, it's not like there hasn't been any work done. It's just that, you know, what we're doing is a patchwork quilt to fixing, you know, broken infrastructure instead of really developing what's needed, which is really new state-of-the-art infrastructure that makes it easier for people to get into and out of and helps, you know, move people. And, you know, we're just way far behind. And it's just one symptom of probably not even the worst. I mean, if you wanted to look at it, our roads, our bridges, you know, far more, and our water systems are far more deteriorated than even our airports are. At least the airports are forced from safety compliance standpoint to keep up to certain standards. You know, some of our roads are just shameless.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing that in the Bay Area right now, where you're seeing sinkholes developed all over the place because of the recent rains. You know, we had the soils underneath are out, and now all of a sudden they're getting washed out. And, you know, part of the Pacific Coast Highway is falling to the ocean. I mean, it's just an embarrassment.
Mm. And you mentioned water systems, and one of the things we saw recently, not really all that far from our headquarters building, is the Oroville Dam, which nearly failed. They had to evacuate I don't know how many thousands of people. But we really are at that point. In fact, Drew Campbell has written about that in the latest edition of Institutional Investing in Infrastructure, that we're really at a point, as you suggest, where we step in and actually spend money on infrastructure when it fails. And oftentimes all we're doing is doing a little bit of retrofitting, patching it up, not really rebuilding it or even retrofitting it in a really significant way.
I mean, Oroville was scary, but it wasn't disastrous. It wasn't a catastrophe. We have had dams break, and they've been catastrophic in the past. It's been a while, not here in California, but elsewhere, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. other places. And, you know, people have lost their lives. It's been horrible. And that could happen again because, again, we've got a lot of earth-filled dams around the country, and Oroville's one of them. And, you know, it was the concrete spillway that gave way because of erosion underneath it. But it could have been a lot worse than it was.
Now, that this whole conversation about infrastructure, which has been going on for years at a federal level, it became almost a competition between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton about who was going to spend more on infrastructure. Donald Trump's in there now, $1 trillion spending plan is what he had talked about. One of the points that have been made by political observers is that that whole plan, which both parties theoretically support the idea of rebuilding our country, it's gotten awfully quiet. You don't hear a lot of talk about the infrastructure plan right now. You had said during an earlier Dorman report that it's really a pittance what they're talking about spending. At the same time, there's a lot of private dollars out there that would like a shot at this. I mean, what do you think about the is there enough private money to accomplish in collaboration with federal spending and state spending to really take care of this problem? Because it's trillions and trillions of dollars we're talking.
Well, there's trillions and trillions of dollars of private capital. So certainly there's enough capital to supply the need. The problem is that it isn't all focused on infrastructure right now. And there isn't enough private infrastructure capital that's been formed in fund form or separate account form to meet and supply all of the needs. But it certainly could make a dent. It could make a difference. The problem we're faced with here in the United States is there's a tremendous amount of political conflict over the issue of whether you should allow private capital to participate in developing what people consider to be, you know, public good assets. And part of it is a reflection of a lack of understanding of history. I mean, the U.S. at one time had one of the best railroad networks in the world, and those railroads were financed largely by public funds that were raised through the public stock markets, and a lot of it raised offshore from foreign investment capital coming to the U.S. Looking at the U.S., it's a cool bet. And it wasn't a slam dunk in those days. Yes, the country was growing very fast, but you could have argued that there were a tremendous amount of risks involved. I mean, right in the middle of the biggest boom in the development of railroads, we had a major civil war that tore the country in two. You know, you look at that, and most of the places you're looking now where you look at is emerging markets where you might have a tremendous opportunity to invest in infrastructure where clearly the need is gigantic and the amount of capital being supplied to meet that need is infinitesimally small. India and Africa and places like this. And people are scared to death of these markets. And yet, they're probably the future.
Now, you say that, but you're talking about Western investors right now, correct? Because China's certainly going overseas and looking to spend a lot of money and get plenty in return for that as well in terms of commitments and so on.
I'm talking about traditional Western forms of capital, which is the capital that we typically tend to serve. You've got to remember that, you know, our, on the institutional side of our business, it's mostly pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, insurance companies. Well, insurance companies in China just recently got authority to move into alternative assets like real estate and infrastructure. The pension fund system in China, while it's relatively small compared to the rest of the world, it's growing, right? And will continue to grow and be a huge pool of capital, is not allowed to even invest in alternatives like this. And so, quite frankly, you know, we don't look at them as a capital source the way we traditionally would look at a capital source. Now, some of the sovereign wealth funds have been investing in these areas. But in most cases, these, particularly the Chinese sovereign wealth funds, are surprisingly understaffed for the amount of capital they have to deploy. So, you know, there's only so many hours in a day and so much that a limited staff can actually do. It's not like there isn't a will to do it. It's just there's a limit to what they're capable of executing, given the size of capital pools that they have to deploy.
Mm-hmm. You know, earlier this week I was talking with a chief investment officer at one of the really big investment houses out there. And I asked him, where's the appetite? I mean, let's other than real estate, which is always kind of front burner, where's the appetite? And he said, infrastructure. He said, there's definitely a high interest in infrastructure. And I said, are you talking overseas? He says, no, I'm talking about right here in the United States. And he said the opportunities are beginning to open up, that despite the misgivings that you were just talking about, opportunities are beginning to open up. There's really not much of a choice in this matter, Jeff, correct? I mean, the governments are strapped
But they become political football. So, for example, there were a few years ago, there was a big deal about some Middle Eastern capital that was going to come in and capitalize a port, okay, take over a port. And everybody got all up in arms. A Muslim country coming in, taking over ports, what about national security? And it became a political issue, all right? It became an absolute political issue, all right? And Can you imagine, the idea of, a Middle Eastern investor coming in and owning a U.S. airport? All right? Why shouldn't they be able to? Capitals, those guys aren't terrorists, right? I mean, they're not going to come in and somehow subvert our economy. They got a vested interest. They own the airport in making it work economically, commercially for them and for the people that use it. And yet, there's this political sensitivity, and politicians will get their hands on it and raise it up to a fever pitch, and all of a sudden public opinion gets either turns completely against it or becomes a hung jury on it, and so it doesn't go forward. And we've seen this time and time again. And then you also have the issues of things that where the consumer has to pay. So water utilities, water rights, right? Big deal. And it's going to become a bigger deal as we move through the century. There's only so much water that's available that's potable and consumable. And who owns that water? Is it a public good, or does the local water company own it, or should a private water company be allowed to come in on it? And then if they do, what are they going to do to the rates? And I thought we all had a right. I mean, you're talking about, people talk about healthcare being a right. Well, what's more of a human right than the right to water? And yet there are millions of people on this earth, probably billions of people on this earth, who access to water is a big thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
They have difficulty getting access to it. We take it for granted. And so instead of finding a way to solve our water infrastructure problems, we debate who has the right to own it.
But the public-private partnerships in those situations, don't the governments involved set the price with escalations built into that? I mean, a water company can't come in and simply say, it's great that we got this contract, now we'll just go ahead and raise the price on this vital.
No, they're subject to regulation, but so was the Flint water system subject to regulation, and something went wrong there. So there's a certain public mistrust of public institutions. I think part of what's going on today in general, and Joshua Cooper Remo pointed this out in his book on networks, that there's a growing mistrust of institutions. Our institutions in many ways are failing us. And so again, it seems so obvious that public and private money public and private money should be partnering to solve these problems for the public good. And yet there's tremendous difficulty in actually implementing and getting these projects done. Take toll roads. There's a toll road project in Southern California. It skirts the outside of the
LAX,
not LAX, but Orange County,
John
Wayne, and it's underutilized. It'll get more utilized as the freeways get even more clogged, right? But people don't want to pay the little fee when they can use free transportation, as if there's such a thing as free transportation systems or free highways or free education, for that matter. I mean, there's no such thing as free.
Right.
We're talking about things that are underwritten by somebody. It's either a public agency or a private partnership or something like that that's going to underwrite these kind of projects. They're not for free.
Well, as a guy who grew up in the Northeast, I'm very used to the idea that you pull up to a toll booth and you throw some money in when you're on, interstate throughways and whatnot. But out west, it's not so much that way, and I guess people are still getting used to that idea. But I have to say, here you are, Jeff, an optimistic guy at heart, but here you are. You actually do sound pessimistic about the infrastructure category or asset class here. And actually, there is a tremendous. Isn't there really tremendous reason for optimism in this asset class, despite the stumbling block?
We've got to solve our political will problem, and politicians have got to stop grandstanding and making political issues out of things that are obviously, if you stopped and thought about it, whatever the issues are they're concerned about, are a greater problem and threat to the future security of their people, all right? I mean, are less of a greater threat than not getting a solution to the infrastructure problem. I mean, again, you can go through China and to almost any major city and find better infrastructure than you can find in almost any major city in the United States. You go to Singapore and everything works, but they've consistently continued to invest. We haven't really consistently continued to invest for 20, 30 years. We pull back. And you can't pay for everything. You can't have it all. You can't have everything. But certain things are expenditures, all right? And other things are investments. They actually return something when you make the dollars. You get back more than you put in. Infrastructure is one of those things that when you invest in it, you get a greater return than your investment back because of the pickup in commerce and the flow of commercial enterprise and the public well-being. So, I mean, to me, it's just crazy that we allow these things to become political footballs when the solutions are much more important than the objections that are being raised to block the long-term solutions. And they really are politically motivated. They have nothing to do with what's for the best interest of the people of the United States or the people of North America, the people of the world.
Well, and that argument's been made over and over again, and with good reason. It's true that, you know, outstanding infrastructure creates a less friction in an economy, and there's definitely an upside to that. It's rocket fuel for an economy.
By the way, rocket fuel for real estate development, because particularly when you're talking about transportation corridors being developed, when you're creating ingress and egress and traffic, you're creating different population flows. You're creating nodes where you can build retail centers, residential centers, you know, all sorts of things. But they all work together. You can build a road, but if you didn't build a water system or a power grid to go along with it, you can't develop around it. So it all goes together. It all fits together.
If you look back at, say, the last 40 years, we have been in the United States on this drumbeat of lower taxes. And the fact of the matter is, I actually went back to look at what the tax rates were when John Kennedy came into office and was talking about lowering tax rates. They were much higher than they are today. And the fact is that although we talk about being overtaxed, we're really not overtaxed when you look at the longer stretch of history and you compare the tax rates that we pay, ineffective tax rates that companies and wealthier individuals pay. I'm not a proponent of higher taxes, but the fact of the matter is we've been on this anti-tax crusade on a federal level for a long time, and infrastructure is expensive, as you were saying. Governments are going to have to participate in some way, even if you're bringing those private investors in. And I don't see any movement right now in this country that people where there's some pushback against this idea that taxes, even now, they're talking about pushing them even lower at a time when we really can't afford it, when you have a bunch of baby boomers moving into their highest consumption years in terms of things like retirement income, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and
yeah,
so on.
Yeah, you can't hold the line on Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and increase defense spending and lower taxes.
And spend $1 trillion in infrastructure.
You can't do all those things. So you're going to have to make choices, and there have to be choices. What Trump appears to be trying to do, or the Trump administration appears to be trying to do, is to disassemble the regulatory framework that they feel has been hamstringing, you know, business development. Well, understandably, there's a lot of constraints on development that have been put in place. Environmental constraints, all kinds of different things. You know, the spotted hootworm or whatever it is that people are trying to protect.
Spotted owl, yeah.
All right. Going back to your thing about taxes, there was a time when the highest marginal tax rate was 73% in the United States. In some of the Nordics, they're higher than that. But also, you have to remember, when they were at that high rate, there were also tremendous loopholes. They used to have something called, prior to the at-risk rules, they didn't have, you could actually put like $5,000 down on a $30,000 investment in equipment, depreciate the equipment over 5 years and get a 5-to-1 write-off or a 3-to-1 write-off. So you borrowed, you know, $25,000, you put $5,000 down, but you wrote off $30,000 worth of an asset over time. We can't do that anymore. You can only write off the amount of money that you have at risk. And so that was a trade-off. And, you know, the whole tax policy system is a system of trade-offs, right? I mean, people wonder, how do we ever get in this crazy situation where we have an income tax to begin with? We didn't used to pay personal income tax until the early 1900s. How did that happen? Well, how it happened is there was a big progressive movement in the country, and the big progressive movement was moving towards open markets. And what they wanted to do was do away with the tariffs. Well, the tariffs, the things that were protectionist, were the things that protected U.S. industry. What they wanted to say is the world's becoming global, so let's release that and create an open free market. Right? But if we do that, we're losing all this tax revenue. Where is the taxes going to come from? But not from tariff taxes. They have to come from somewhere, and the trade-off was an income tax. Just a little bit. Just a small income tax wouldn't hurt anybody, just a little bit. And now they're taking up to 53% federal and state when you have a state tax. So, you know, it's grown. And at one time, as you say, it was up to 73% marginal. In some Nordic countries, can go up to 90% marginal tax. But a lot of people don't even understand a progressive tax system. And, you know, that doesn't mean that you're paying 90% of every dollar you make. It means you're paying 90% of every marginal dollar you make above a certain progressive rank.
Mm. Well, and also nobody understands a 10,000 page, and it's not literally 10,000, but it's about 10,000 page tax code that is unpredictable and allows some people to get a bit of a free ride. I mean, like I said, effective tax rate versus, there's been talk about a flat tax. It never seems to happen. Let's talk though about, I want to hear what you think it's going to take to get from here to there in terms of infrastructure.
Well, you want me to stay focused on what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, it's all related. It's, you know, obviously you need cash flow, but how do we get from here to there? We have a political problem, and we do have a financial problem. Maybe that's completely rooted in the political problem. I don't know, but how do we make progress on this?
I think the infrastructure industry as an investment industry and a construction industry, because largely it's a construction industry driven business, needs to develop a stronger lobby, and that lobby needs to be aiming at Congress, which seems to have the will, but more importantly at their constituencies at a local level, and doing massive education programs to help people understand that, again, investing in infrastructure is not spending money. It's investing money for the future. It really, truly is investing. And it really doesn't matter whether it comes from the private sector or the public sector. Okay? It really doesn't. What matters is the investment be made so that we can get that commercial return on investment that's going to accrue to everybody. Anybody who drives around the Bay Area, you know, it used to be that rush hour was horrible. And now it's that rush hour is all hours of the day. And you can't get anywhere. It's gridlock everywhere you go. It's become one of the most congested traffic areas in the country. There's no plans to fix that.
No. They're talking about extending BART, but it costs an enormous amount of money, and it takes them forever to do that. BART being, for those of you who don't live in the San Francisco Bay Area, our train and subway system. But let me stop
you. But they're also single line. They're not trunk systems, and so there's no way to get from one part of BART to another part of BART except in a straight line. And so it's not like the New York subway system where you can get just about anywhere by transferring stations, or the London subway system or the Paris metro system. I mean, these are true transportation systems. These are just lines that are allowed to, you know, you've got to use a car to get to the BART station to begin with.
Right.
Or use public transportation to get to the BART system.
Yeah. And it doesn't even, it's not even a complete loop around the bay, which doesn't make any sense at all. It should be running through Silicon Valley
right. And
all. Let's get back, though, for a minute. You're talking about, I'm not so sure it's an education problem. I mean, don't members of Congress understand that infrastructure is good? We understand that. Isn't it more that they are influenced by campaign contributions and dollars? And what you're talking about is the construction industry laying a heavier hand on Congress. And the only way you can really do that.
But they don't get blocked. See, the problem is, Michael, they don't get blocked at Congress. They get blocked at the local level.
Mm.
All right? And so the education...
They take contributions, too.
Yeah. It has to be done at a grassroots level. And there needs to be a political will and a political commitment to infrastructure development for the good of everybody living in a region, or it's not going to happen. And that's where the education needs to occur, to the average everyday Joe worker who sees this money being spent and wonders what the Bloombergville is all about. How come I'm not getting some of it? You know, and is this really fair? And now I'm going to have to pay higher tolls on the freeway, or have to pay higher water rates, or my electrical utility bill is going to go up. You know, there isn't enough education being done. You know, anybody who's on the other side, if you're in the real estate and development business and you're working in a local region, you know that it can take years to get the political will lined up to support your project. And that's really community development work. And, you know, people look at the huge profits the developers make. They don't look at the years that go by where they're just doing nothing but putting money into the project, and a lot of it just to keep an office open so they can continue to go out and educate people in the local community, get people to sign petitions and come to community hearings and get the people to testify at community hearings in favor of the project, the amount of community development, the
environmental impact surveys,
all of that,
the development fees, which is basically those development fees go to just the surrounding infrastructure, the roads, extension of power lines and water lines,
sewer
and all
systems.
That. So sewer systems, but that's just localized infrastructure around that development. But yeah, what your point is well taken.
I'm saying the process of getting major infrastructure projects done is going to have to get better organized at the local community level to get that kind of support to allow it to go through. And usually you're talking about not municipalities. You're talking about regions, you know, counties or whole communities or sometimes whole states behind the project.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot more complicated, a lot more moving parts. And, you know, a lot of times you're advantaging one group of people, and you may not be disadvantaging another group of people, but they may feel disadvantaged because they feel lesser because somebody else is going to get the advantage of having that local infrastructure run through. I mean, one of the driving factors between the Civil War, you know, surrounding the Civil War was where was the, you know, Western Pacific Railroad route going to go through? Is it going to go through the South or the North? That was a big divisive issue. You know, Lincoln Douglas debates. Douglas wanted the South. Lincoln wanted the North. Eventually went through the North.
What U.S. state is doing the best job with infrastructure?
Goodness, I haven't got a clue. I'm not that well plugged into it. You could ask Drew Campbell that. He would know. I really don't know for sure on that. Traveling around, looking around, it's hard being from California not to feel just about every other state, but California is doing a better job. But I know that's not true.